Good evening, you all. K2 Romeo India Whiskey, my call letters. R is my call letters. Along with K2KEY, Mel, we intend to run this thing called the TechNet, along with the help of people like WS2N and K2N2EO, a whole bunch of other people. And we try to answer people's questions on the subject of ham radio. A slightly complicated hobby, but step by step we make it a little bit easier. A person signs into the TechNet by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and a confirming yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Typical sign-in would sound like this, WS2N, Paul, and yes. So do we have any check-ins? Please give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
M2EO Rich, no questions.
K2LDK, Sam, yes.
K2KYQ, yes.
I got a new tone. This is K2KTY, and good evening to all.
KC2RGW, Chris, no.
Okay, so far we've got no, Rich, Sam, Blank, and Chris. K2KYQ, can you tell me your name, sir?
The handle is Joe. K2KYQ, Joe.
Very fine, Joe. Okay, anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters and names at this time.
Y.O. Bernie, you have some questions.
Okay, Y.O. Bernie, what's your prefix, Bernie? Is it K2?
Affirmative, yes. Kilo 2, Yankee, Austin.
Okay, we got Bernie. Anyone else? Okay. The first person who signed in with a yes was Sam, K2LD, can't read, LD blank, can't read my own writing here, Sam, correct me, K2RIW, my name is Vic.
Good evening, Vic, K2RIW, K2LDK, and the name is Sam. I'm trying to wind toroidal transformers for, trying to change phase between two inputs, toroidal transformers, and I've got to be able to determine the phase of the windings, and I have no experience at this, and I need a little bit of help. Have I sort of laid this out?
Yes, I think you have. What a lot of people do is to twist two leads together to make a bipolar winding, 2, 3, 4, however many wires are required, and one sexy way of doing it would be to put the labels on the wires while they're separate before you wind them into the transformer. That's one approach. Another approach is to check with an ohmmeter which lead connects, which input wire connects to what output wire. That can help. If the wires were wound together around each other before being wound onto the toroidal transformer, which is the nicest way to get the lowest stray inductance and the most amount of coupling with the toroid, then by definition, all the wiring is in the same direction, and as long as you can recognize input lead and output lead, then the phasing would all be identical. In other words, if I've got two input wires, which I'm going to label A and B, and I've got two output wires, which I'm going to label A prime and B prime, and I can check them with my ohmmeter, then whatever voltage I put between A and A prime, like a 6.3 volt filament transformer connected there, I will see similar voltage between B and B prime. And if I have any doubt as to whether or not I've properly identified the input lead and output lead of winding B, I think this wire is B and that wire is B prime, and I might have them reversed. There's one way I can tell pretty sure, and that is to put the two windings in series. If I put a voltage across A to A prime, and then connect B to A prime, and look at the total voltage from A to B prime, I should see something close to twice the voltage that I'm applying between A and A prime. I've got them in phase. And if I reverse B and B prime, because I've got some doubt, now the two voltages would be bucking each other, and I would get close to 0 volts out. So by putting a known AC voltage into one winding of the transformer and measuring what comes out of the other windings, you can tell the magnitude, but the phasing is a little bit difficult until you start putting them in series. And you can put them in series either in phase or out of phase. In phase, the voltage will add. Out of phase, the voltage will almost cancel. So that's the best way that guys do it. The next more elaborate way is to use an oscilloscope. But I won't go there right now. Let's see if that little bit so far helps there, Rich. I mean, Sam. KC2LVK. K2LVK. K2RIW in the deck net.
Dick, there's another way in 2EO.
Stand by, Rich. I mean, Sam. Go ahead, Rich. Tell us your other way.
Yeah, I've done this with regular AC transformers. You put them in parallel, but what you do is one pair, instead of putting them just in parallel, you put a voltmeter across one transformer to the other. If they're in phase, you'll see zero voltage. If they're out of phase in the bucket, you'll see voltage.
Now let's assume I've got two windings on a transformer, Rich, and I want to tell their phasing. Are you telling me I should feed the two wires, the two windings, I should feed, in other words, put A and B together, and put A prime and B prime together, and then try to feed them that way? That would be truly parallel. Is that what you're suggesting, Rich? Go ahead.
Okay, if you take two 6-volt transformers, put A to A, and A prime, let's say A to A and B to B, but instead of putting B to B, you put a voltmeter in there. So if you see them, if you see a voltage there, then they're bucking. If they're truly in phase, you'll see zero voltage.
Okay, I think I see where Rich is going here. He's assuming he has two thoroughly independent transformers. So let's assume they're 6.3 volt output filament transformers, 110 volt primaries. And he feeds both primaries together, 110 volts, in parallel. And he takes the secondary wires and connects up one wire from transformer A to one wire of transformer B. Then the remaining wire of A and the remaining wire of B, he puts his voltmeter across it. And depending on whether or not he sees twice voltage, which would be 12 volts in this case, or nearly 0 volts, that tells him if they're in phase and out of phase, two thoroughly independent transformers. Not a very good way of doing it. So I think you see some of the technique here, Sam. K2LDK, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2KY, doing it all wrong, you guys.
Okay. Mel's got an even better way. Let's find out how the guys in the southwestern Brooklyn do it. K2KEY, go right ahead.
Hey, hello. When working with a toroid, you're going to be working with most likely wire that's maybe 36 wire and all. Stop with the bowls. Things on it and everything like that, you may get a little frying going on there. It's easiest way to take an oscilloscope and a audio generator, and you will just look at a nice clean sine wave, and the sine wave will very quickly tell you if they're in parallel with the windings, if they're bucking, if they're series, and everything. And do all your testing and not worry about plugging a transformer into the wall or anything like that. Use a simple audio generator as your source of a sine wave and a scope. And in fact, if you don't have the scope available, use an AC-DTVF. Use an old AC-DTVF. It's great to use an analog meter. Just, you know, you'll go crazy with a digital, be bouncing all over the place. So either way, that's the way to work with it, because this way you have no problem of frying or anything, or burning or heating, and worrying about, you know, the current that's going to finding a transformer that has very low current, won't give you any kind of headache, over.
Yeah, Mel's got a good point here, Sam, and that is the toroidal transformer you're winding, if you happen to be winding it for an RF frequency, like 80 meters, then its response to 60 cycles, which is an extremely low frequency to that transformer, might be pretty poor. You can protect yourself in situations like that by making sure the voltage is low enough, like a 6.3 volt filament transformer, and maybe a variac on the primary to cut down the primary. Another way you can protect yourself is make sure that your source of voltage, like if it's a 6.3 volt filament transformer, make sure you've got a resistor in series, like a 10 ohm resistor or something like that, so that if at worst your transformer really doesn't work at that lower frequency, then the voltage drop will occur across the 10 ohm resistor instead of across your winding, which could potentially be burned up. But Mel's idea is to use a audio oscillator or an RF signal generator, something that goes high enough in frequency so now that the toroid is working. So everything we said, Rich, I, and Mel, the higher the frequency you put on the transformer, within reason, the better the transformer will respond. The funny thing about a transformer is that if it was designed for proper operation at 80 meters, 3.5 megacycles, and you feed it a frequency of 60 cycles, it's so low, the transformer may have no primary winding inductance left, and it may almost not respond. So making the frequency high enough, if the transformer has too few turns for that low frequency to be operational, that's another thing to keep in mind. As you can tell, the number of people who feel comfortable with transformers, the right number of windings for the size of the core, the right frequency response, primary and secondary windings, auto transformer windings, in phase, out of phase, quadrifiler, trifiler, bifiler windings, and so on. The number of us who feel comfortable with transformers is an extremely small fraction of the population. As you acquire this knowledge, Sam, they're going to put a big star on your report card. Hams will flock to your particular neighborhood to find out to tap into this knowledge that you're about to get. You're going to know a rare art and science, and you'll get all of our respect as you do it, Sam. K2LZK, K2RIW, listening.
One more thing, Dick. K2KY.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, if you look at the chart and you look at inductance, if you see that if you have an audio generator that goes up to, say, 400,000 or 500,000 kilohertz, and you look at, say, put a 0.1, 0.01 capacitor in there, you can then notice on a chart that you can read down to a few microhenries, very, very small inductance, I think, over.
Okay, resonating the transformer is another thing. At the rate you're going, Sam, you're going to be one of the very few guys in Old Best Page that understands transformer theory. We're going to let you talk now, Sam. K2LDK, K2LIW.
K2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, hold on a little bit. Let's let Sam get an edge in word-wise here. Go ahead, Sam.
Okay, well, that's an awful lot to gather in one little QSO, but what I'm taking is the output from a ICOM 756, and I'm going to feed it into two decks of MOSFET, and I've got to drop the impedance, so I've got to wind a 6-to-1 toroidal-type transformer, because I'm going to operate the MOSFET 180 degrees out of phase, I have to change the phase of one of the... you get the idea. So I'm just trying to figure out exactly how to do it the first time, so that I don't get them in phase and wind up defeating the purpose of having the two banks. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, you're in a fairly exotic area here, Glenn. Correction, Sam. That is, when you're feeding MOSFET high power transistors and you want to run them push-pull, my strongest recommendation is that hopefully the manufacturer of the transistors has given you a sample circuit, a sample way of hooking it up. That can help an awful lot. For an amateur without a whole lot of experience to just read the data sheet without a hint on a MOSFET and do a good job of impedance matching the input and the output, input and output impedance matching and proper phasing. There's quite a bit involved here. So I hope that there is a sample circuit in the data sheet, or I'm hoping you can find an application note from the manufacturer who suggests a circuit on how to use it for near your frequency range. That'll help a whole lot. Let's see what Glenn's got to say. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Vic and group out there. I've worked on a couple of transformers, and generally with toroids, one thing nice about them is usually a left-hand side and a right-hand side with a hole in the center. And usually the wires that come out of one side, you can pull a start, and whatever the wires that come out on the other side, you can pull the finish. Typically, starts on a transformer are usually the winding that's closest to the bottom of the core, and the finish are the windings that are all the way up on the top. So if you can look at the toroid and look at one side and see the wires coming out of one side and it's close to the top, you know that those are all the finishes. You look on the other side of the transformer, where the wires are going into the core from the bottom, those are the starts. So basically just like kind of like holding the cross-sectional area of the transformer, looking at it that way, and looking at the wires coming outside of the hole on one side and the inside of the hole on the other side. And it's a very optical way of just holding a transformer in your hand and seeing where the starts and the finishes are. And of course, if all the starts are on one side, then you're in phase, whether they're in series or parallel, depending on how you think them up later. The other preferred method I like is generally measuring inductance, but I think you're coming up with KC2QIQ.
No, we haven't gotten into yet how to measure inductance, and that's another whole art and science. I think, Glenn, you're talking about a kind of a ferrite transformer, which is a block of ferrite with two separate holes going through it, not just one toroid. You're talking about a two separate hole type of ferrite, I think, which is often used for input and output matching of push-pull transistors. Let me pass it back to you, Glenn, because where you talked about the starts and the finishes, it didn't sound like one single donut like toroid that you're talking about. Over to you, Glenn.
It actually works for either way, but even if it's a single hole in a single donut transformer, if you take one wire and run it through the center of the hole, that's one turn. If you wrap it around a second time and go through, that's the second turn. But if the wire is coming in from the left-hand side going through the hole, that would be the start, and when it comes out the other side, it's the finish. So if you're holding if you're looking at the circular part of the transformer and then turn sideways and look at a left-hand side and a right-hand side, all the wires on the left-hand side would be the start, and all the ones on the right-hand side would be the finishes. Is that more clear, Dick?
Yes, it is. Particularly as long as you're not completely filling up the transformer and wrapping all the way around its perimeter, that would be pretty easy. One of the things to know about transformers, Sam, which may not be clear until you've worked with them, is that whatever phase you put on a winding, you tend to get the exact same phase on the adjacent winding if it's wound in the same direction. So if you were putting two windings on a transformer, two separate chunks of wire, and you start off by taking the two chunks of wire, and the nicest way to do it would be to wrap by enameled wire that comes both red and green. So one wire is red, one wire is green, you choose the right length, chop it off, twist the red and the green together before you begin to wind them on the transformer. That would be the nicest way to do it. Because of the color coding, and you know which ones you started which ones you ended with, you would now know for sure phasing, polarity, which one is which, and so on. If I put a particular voltage across the red winding, and I put one lead of my signal generator, let's call it the ground, the hot lead of the signal generator goes on the input wire of red, and the second wire from my signal generator goes on the output wire of red. So I'm feeding a signal across red. Then when I go with my sensing device on the green wire, start and finish, I will get, in theory, the exact same voltage with the exact same phase. The way people talk about the current leading and lagging and whatever on a transformer, this can all become kind of confusing. But if the transformer is a pretty good one, and I put a 1 megacycle signal across the red winding, I should get 1 volt at 1 megacycle. I should get very close to 1 volt at 1 megacycle coming out of the green winding. And when I compare phasing of red winding versus green winding with an oscilloscope or other methods of testing, they should be almost identical. Almost 0 degrees phase shift between windings, as long as they're wound in the same direction. Reverse the way you're using the green winding when I'm feeding the red winding, and yes, I'll get the exact same voltage, 1 volt, but they'll now be out of phase. It can be confirmed with an oscilloscope. It can be confirmed by putting the green winding in series with the red winding and finding out if the voltage from beginning to end, beginning of red to end of green, whether the voltage is higher or lower. You can find out real fast on the in phase or out of phase. Is the voltage bucking or adding? It's somewhat similar to what happens when you take two flashlight batteries and you put the two flashlight batteries in series. Each flashlight battery, although it's DC, AC works in a rather similar manner.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Each flashlight battery may be 1.5 volts. Put the two of them in series where you've got the tip of one going into the bottom of the second, and you measure across the pair, you'll measure 3 volts. Reverse one of the batteries. So you start off at the bottom of one, put the two tips together, and then go to the bottom of the second one. You know darn well they're out of phase, and you'll measure very close to 0 volts. For windings of a transformer, although the signal is AC instead of DC, it behaves in a rather similar manner. Maybe this helps a little bit, Sam. K2LDK, K2RIW for TechNet.
WS2N for Andy CDL, if he's on frequency, Dick.
Okay, I didn't hear Andy respond yet. Maybe he will be here a little bit later. Usually signs a little bit later, Paul. Sam, K2LDK, you got it.
I just want to let him know that it's just a carrier on a cell phone machine, Dick.
Understand.
Okay, I think that's me.
Yeah, K2LDK for ID.
No, I think I have a system here, and I think I'll be able to, I think I'll be able to figure this out, or at least I certainly will be able to test it when I get the windings done. And it is a, it's not a donut-shaped toroid. It's actually going to be these long, elongated ferrite beads. I have to put two or three of them together to get the proper, to have it done properly. So, yeah, I'm going to, I'll wind them and then I'll be able to test them. I got to get the 6-to-1 windings in the little holes. Should be interesting. All right, thank you very much. I will stand by. Thank you, Dick. K2LDK.
Yeah, depending on how this works out, Sam, come back next week or the week after and let us know. Because, out of curiosity, the, MOSFET transistors with the 6-to-1 winding ratio that you're about to create, what power level is this amplifier going to run at? Are we talking about a 100-watt type amplifier here, Sam? Go ahead.
I'm going to drive it with 35 watts of from the transceiver, and it should put out close to 500 on 80 meters.
Okay, that's a nice amplifier. MOSFETs on 80 meters have an input impedance that's almost a pure capacitance and a very high resistance. So hopefully your toroids will do some kind of resonating. I'm a bit amazed that 35 watts of drive is required. Are you driving the gates of these FETs or are you driving the sources of these FETs? Back to you, Sam.
Yeah, the output from these transformers goes to the gates of the FETs.
And the design you're following, does it recommend 35 watts of drive? That strikes me as a rather high number for a FET. Go ahead.
Well, actually, they design it two ways. You can drive it with 5 watts, and then they have drivers to get to exactly what they're using, because they decided not to use it. I think they are, DEIC-420. And so doing away with that, since I have more power available, you can probably drive with a little bit less on 80. If you design it for 160 meters, I think you certainly do need the 35 watts.
Well, if you design it for 40, you certainly need more than 40, 35 watts. So at 80 meters, you probably need about 35. Go ahead.
Yeah, what is the model number of your power MOSFET transistors?
Let's see, we're using FQA 11N90.
I comment, KTKY.
Okay, Sam recognized, Mel recognized. FQA 11N90, that's Fox Quebec Alpha 11 Nancy 90. That's what it sounded like you said, Sam, go ahead.
Yeah, affirmative. Two banks of five of those each. So there are a total of 10 transistors.
Wow. Okay. Mel, go right ahead.
Okay, I built, I salvaged and I rebuilt it. It's a MOSFET HF amplifier that runs approximately 100 watts. And I'm able to get that 100 watts up with approximately, I think I measured about 10 dBm of drive, Nick. So it's amazing that my little QRP radio easily pushes the 100 watts from the MOSFET amplifier. And I'm using MRF 150, Nick, over.
Sounds like Motorola devices, MRF 150s. Yeah, I'm amazed that 35 watts of drive is required into the gates of these transistors. Buddy's driving a total of 10 transistors, two banks of five each. Interesting amplifier. Is there a application note with that exact layout, to your knowledge, that you're following, Sam, or is this somebody's article? In other words, what is the source of the schematic diagram that you're about to build? I'm back to you for another comment on that one, Sam.
Okay, this is a Class E amplifier. I'm going to drive it with a Class H AM modulator. So this is for AM work on 80 meters. Similarly on 40 and 160. So that's it. It does have a very detailed schematic. And it's really very simple. And for the Class H amplifier, Class H modulator, there are boards available. Just to make it very simple. It's a really nice project, and there's a detailed schematic. The only thing that I had a problem with was I didn't understand exactly how they were feeding the transistors and how the phase would work. And that was the question. I figured out that there was a phase for the transformers, and they had to be reversed. And then you have the output transformers. They have to be reversed to bring the signals back in phase again and add together. Complicated, but it's very detailed. Go ahead.
Sam, what is the source of this schematic? Is this an amateur radio article, or is this an application note from the manufacturer of the transistors? Back to you, Sam.
This is the website of WA1QIX. Steve up in Massachusetts. It is a professional designed rig that he's allowed amateurs to build. And I was up in Connecticut, I think 2 days ago, taking a look at a completed one and looked at it in great detail, but came away with just some questions about the transformers. Go ahead.
Okay. Sounds like you've had a good source. WA1 Quebec India X-ray. And I guess if I look him up on QRZ or whatever, I'll find his email address, his website, maybe it's at coolletters.com, will show me that schematic. Sounds like a fun project. Let us know how it turns out. Okay, the next person who signed in with a yes was Joe, K2KYQ. You got it, Joe, K2LIW.
Dick M2EO, would you put me at the end to have a comment to the net concerning something that was mentioned last week?
Yep, you're on the list. Go ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick. Yeah, so all this highest level technical stuff, I think I've got a... I've been sitting here for a couple of weeks now, mulling over my wall charges that I use to keep my AA and AAA batteries charged. And, of course, every time there's a ham fest, the rating on those batteries double and triple. When I bought these wall charges, they're both radio, well, one's a Radio Shack and the other's an Energizer charger, not simple little things. They hold four batteries. And that the rating has gone from like 1200 to 1800, and the last set I got was 2700 milliamp hours. That's pretty cool. I'm really happy with it. They drive my radios well, and they drive the cameras that I've got. Very good. The thing that bothers me, though, looking at the charges, is look at the rating. I understand it says that 2.8 volts. In order to charge these batteries, you've got to be above the voltage of the battery. And one of these charges, it appears like you put a bank of four batteries in, and they're all in parallel. So put 2.8 volts towards that, and you're going to start pushing current into it. Then they give the rating. And the fast, the one that's marked as a fast charger says 1,200 milliamps when you're charging two AAA batteries. It'll run 600 milliamps when you're charging four AA batteries. Now, does that mean that it's going to take longer for the batteries to reach their full potential, or does it mean it's only going to charge up to 600 milliamp hours? I don't know what I'm facing the question right there.
I think I see what you're asking, Joe, and it's a good question. I personally have done quite a bit of charging of nickel metal hydride, nickel cadmium, and occasionally some lithium ion type batteries. The milliampere hour rating of a battery, assuming the manufacturer is telling you the truth, really tells you how many milliamps you can draw out of it for how many hours. A battery, your best battery that you talked about was 2,700 milliampere hours, which is really 2.7 ampere hours. So you could draw 27 milliamps out of that battery, divide 27 milliamps to 2,700, you come up with 100 as an answer. In other words, you could draw 27 milliamps out of that battery for 100 solid hours, in theory, before it's completely dead. A 2.7 ampere hour battery, 2700 milliampere hours, doesn't mean you can necessarily draw 2.7 amps. Every battery's got a maximum current at which you shouldn't exceed. So discharging it, as long as you're within the range of proper current that the battery is rated for, you divide that current into the milliampere hours, and it tells you how many hours you're going to get on discharge. In the case of charge, the battery can't manufacture energy. Let me drop. You're going to put that number of milliampere hours back into each individual cell, each individual battery, and then some. No battery is 100% efficient between the milliampere hours you put in and the milliampere hours you get back out. I'm going to pick a number out of the air, but maybe it's close. Maybe you've got to put in 125%, 1.25 times the amount of milliampere hours you have to put in order to fully charge it. And my experience has told me also that so-called fast charging, you got to be careful with that. A 2.7 ampere hour battery, you would think you could plug 2.7 amps into it for 1 hour and it would be fully charged. If you did that, it would be very foolish. Very foolish, because 2.7 amps on a AAA or a AA is a huge amount of current. You put in that much current, and if the battery is fully discharged, in the beginning, it will take that amount of current while you're charging, no sweat. But if you thought the battery was fully discharged, and therefore you think you would have to do 2.7 amps for a solid hour, and if you were wrong, you had only half discharged the battery, so that, in other words, before you got to the full hour, in 30 minutes, the battery is now fully charged. What happens when the battery is fully charged, and you continue to pour current into it, the extra current can no longer be converted into chemical action, because you've already used up all the chemistry, so to speak, if the battery is fully charged. All excess current you put beyond that point must be turned into heat. There's nothing else the battery can do with it. You put 2.7 amps into a battery that's fully charged, that's rated 27 milliampere hours, and in a few minutes, you're going to create an amount of heat that you're going to be outgassing, and there's a slim possibility you can create an explosion if there isn't a real good safety valve on the thing. So most of the really fast chargers, let me drop, do one, two, or three things. So there are some really dumb chargers in the world, and there's some really fast, smart chargers. A smart charger pours in a lot of current in the beginning and then starts tapering off on the current it's pouring in as the battery comes up to full charge. And on most of these batteries, you can tell the status of the charge by measuring the voltage at that time. If you plotted voltage across a cell while you're charging it at constant current, you'll watch the voltage slowly climb. And so if you've got the right kind of a curve memorized somewhere in your microprocessor of your smart charger, it recognizes the fact that maybe your particular nickel-cadmium battery runs around 1.2 volts when it's just sitting on the shelf, and when you're charging it, maybe it goes up to 1.8 volts, 1.9 volts, something like that when it's fully charged. I'm making up numbers, but the voltage will slowly climb, and a smart charger will recognize that the climbing voltage means you're getting close to full charge, and it starts tapering off on the current. It goes to a trickle charge near the end in order to fully top off the battery without overheating it. An even smarter charger and a smarter battery has a couple of extra contacts in there where it can measure the temperature, because when you overcharge a battery, the extra current you're pouring in gets turned into heat. As the battery starts climbing in temperature, a smart charger will recognize that and again know not only because of climbing voltage but because of climbing temperature it must back off. So as I said, there are a few very smart chargers out there. There's an awful lot of dumb chargers that used to be used by Motorola, among other companies, that would cook the living daylights out of batteries and really shorten their life some years. You have a battery like a nickel metal hydride or a nickel cadmium battery. Let me drop. You let it sit in the mode where you're pouring a lot of current into it. The battery's already up to full charge. You think the extra current you're plugging in is just making sure it's fully charged. In reality, all that extra current's being turned into heat. The extra heat can definitely be shortening the life of the battery. And I've seen a lot of examples of that. So when you've got more batteries in series, correction, in parallel, so that now the current coming out of your charger is being shared, in theory, it takes a longer period of time. The next question to worry about is, what is the proper turnoff time for your charger? Are you timing it with your watch after following the data sheet and it says that you're getting this number of milliamps into each individual cell? If you've got two cells or four cells in parallel, and therefore you have to figure out the time yourself, or does it have some kind of a timer built in, or some kind of a microprocessor? These are some of the questions to ask yourself, because in theory, most of the batteries we buy, these high-performance batteries, are a little bit on the expensive side, and we amateurs are kind of economical guys. We'd like to have the battery last for a whole lot of cycles. You treat a nickel-cadmium battery really well. Don't over-discharge it. Don't overcharge it. Use it right in the right range of current in charging them, both charge and discharge and so on. You do it really well, you will get 500 complete cycles out of a nickel-cadmium and maybe more. You discharge it in ways that are way too deep. You charge it in ways that are much too aggressive. You may only get 40 cycles out of it before it becomes very low in its ampere-hour capacity. So, you've got to be a little bit careful. I know I haven't directly answered your questions, but maybe some of this information is somewhat helpful to you, Joe. K2KYQ, drag your feet a little bit in case some of our other battery experts here want to chime in. K2LIW on the deck next.
K2KY.
Bell recognized. Anyone else? Okay. Bet you charge some batteries in your time. Tell us how you get around it real well, Mel. Go ahead. K2KY.
Yeah, the charging of cells in parallel is not really a great way of going, because you're depending that all the cells, you know, have the same capacity. And what could happen if one cell, it does not have the capacity and is charging up faster, it's going to be fully charged, and the others are going to either start to sap them down, and you're going to go back and forth. So I don't really suggest charging, you know, cells individually, like 1.5 volt battery in parallel. You're better off having, like I'm using, when I have the, you know, the condition of cells up, I like to do them first. If I'm going to put together a pack, is to individually, you know, condition them up one at a time. You know, bring them up, reset cycle them down and, you know, bring them up, and I'll see if I can get them balanced as best as possible. But it's a problem child when you have NiCad or metal hydride to, you know, get them all equally charged when they're in parallel deck over.
And whether it's parallel or series, it's a problem. When you've got brand new batteries, fresh out of the box from a particular manufacturer, all part of the same manufacturing lot, in theory, they're pretty well matched. By the time you've used the batteries and gone through, let me pick a number, 25 charge and discharge cycles, the chances are significant that some of those cells are no longer in the same condition. When they're in series, you may have one particular cell that has a little bit higher leakage rate. In other words, it's got an internal equivalent parallel resistor where it's slowly discharging the battery. You take a nickel cadmium battery, fully charge it, put it on the shelf, and walk away. A month later, you come back, it may only have 50% of the charge left. And where did the 50% go? The equivalent resistor, the leakage resistor of that particular cell, slowly discharged it while it was sitting on the shelf. Well, if I put the four cells on that shelf, fully charged today, and I wait a month, I may find that two of them are down to 60%, one of them is down to 40%. And if I put those particular cells in series, I don't have a matched set. And the disadvantage of an unmatched set is that the one with the lower capacity will hit the bottom first, and now the other cells will continue to crank. Therefore, the one that hit bottom is now going to be reversed charged by the other two that are still cranking. And it's a destructive process where it grows whiskers, and so whatever imbalance you have in the battery tends to grow more of an imbalance. This problem is really serious when they're in series. When they're in parallel, there's another set of problems that happen, but in my mind, it's a little bit less severe, because when they're in parallel, hopefully they all have a similar voltage versus state of charge curve, and as such, in parallel, they're all getting the same voltage at the same time, and therefore the one that has the least amount of charge will try to sit at a lower voltage. It will automatically draw more current, and so in parallel, the balancing of the charge is a little bit better than it would be in series. In series, by the way, the only way you can fully charge cells that are in series is by that trickle charge technique I mentioned earlier. A fair amount of current in the beginning, but as the voltage of the whole battery pack starts rising, you better cut back to a much lower charging current so that you're not significantly overheating the ones that have already reached full charge, and the one that hasn't reached full charge is taking that same current, because they're all in series, but it's putting it into real chemical action, and you get a chance to bring them all up to the tippy top. So a variable charge rate is very required for series batteries, and it's somewhat required for parallel batteries. Maybe this helps a little bit to Joe.
Repeater, timeout,
cancel. So, one of the things you can do is to take your cells after they've been fully charged, make yourself a discharge circuit if you don't already have one. In other words, calculate that in the case of a 1200 milliampere hour battery, putting a 100 milliampere discharge on it by choosing the right value resistor is one way of doing it, and then make yourself a plot with a good digital voltmeter, what voltage versus each 10 minutes in time or each half hour in time did you see. You can actually trace out the charge-discharge curve of your particular cells. It's a very educational process. It'll help you in the future know how to recharge them in a way that's bringing them up to full charge without damaging them. And as I said before, treat your cells really right, and you may get 500 discharge-charge cycles out of them. K2KYQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Wow. Okay. Holy smokes. You know, I thought I was pretty smart. About 2 years back, I purchased a Maha intelligent charger, which I used for my big batteries that come with the HD. And I have to tell you, I had three spares in my Icon W32A, and I lost one of them after a year and a half, and that was the one I left in the
HT, and I was charging it before each event with the wall charger. The other two, though, I put into the intelligent charger and cycled it through, you know, the Maha, and it's still running strong. So what you're saying, basically, is that I should back off a little bit here and use the Maha to charge the batteries, and ideally charge the batteries singularly, or I'm looking at this Radio Shack charger, which is the one that is rated at the, it says on there, if you're charging two double A, you're putting 1200 milliamps in, and this is the one that gets hot. So I've been hurting the batteries. I'm going to tear this one apart and make, you know, sort of rewire it and set it up so I can charge, if I read you right, it's better to charge the cells in series with the intelligent charger, because it will ultimately, when it reaches a certain point, automatically drop into a trickle charge, which is Maha does too. Good. Hey, Dick, that was very good. That was very good. I've been blindly plugging these things in, and my original thought on this, my original question was, will I get the full charge into the battery? But that's the wrong way of looking at this. Without having put a voltmeter on it, I could be turning up my battery, but the voltage apparently doesn't drop down into a triple mode. Thank you very much, guys. KKYQ.
Joe, you said some magic words when you said the batteries get hot. If your charger and the way you're using it ever makes a battery get hot to the touch, usually that is not good. A little bit warm, okay. But hot to the touch, most likely some damage is taking place. A smart charger will never create a hot battery. And if you felt heat, significant heat on any one of those batteries when you're charging, most likely something is wrong. Not the Maha charger, but the dumb charger you've used in the past. How do you know when to turn it off? Have you been timing it? Have you been measuring voltage? And by the way, what I've done on my battery chargers, even if they don't have appropriate terminals that I can get to, I've added my own banana plug terminal so I can plug in my digital voltmeter and watch it during the charge cycle. Watch what's going on. To me, that's a real eye-opener. So how hot did those cells get? And the previous dump charger, how did you know when to stop using it, Joe? Go ahead.
You really want to embarrass me in front of all these people, Dick, huh? I plug them in the evening, and I come back the next morning, take them out, put them into the can. It's just that on occasion, when I've been in and out of my area where I've got all this set up, I will touch charger, the Radio Shack fast charger, and they would be hot. And when I feel that, I'd unplug it for a little while, let it cool down, and then plug it back in again and leave the room. So I have not been careful. And I agree with everything you guys said tonight. I think I'm just not going to use the fast charger anymore. I'm going to rewire it so it looks like it comes apart pretty simple. And I'll just go inside and rip the touch out and use it as a mount. I do need to charge several batteries at a time because I can't just sit here and watch these things. I've got to go to work each day, and I'll set this thing up so the Maha can do the work. Does that sound okay, Dick?
Dick came to KEY. I wanted to make a statement about this. Over.
Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Mel in a minute, then. Don't feel bailed, Joe. Lots and lots of people, very smart people, have misused the daylight out of the battery chargers simply because the manufacturer supplied a charger that looked like it was doing the right thing. It had the right physical appearance, and the instruction manual sounded reasonable. But there's a whole process of care and feeding to properly treat any rechargeable batteries. It's a real art and science to properly charging rechargeable batteries. It's not simple. We're all in the learning curve here. And let's see what Mel's got to say. K2KEY, K2RIW.
I've looked at a number of professional portable instruments, how they charge the batteries. And a number of them, they use, you know, in other words, they tell you that, of course, you should have a second set while one set is being charged. And that's basically that way we've been, you know, using the charge, the batteries that we used on the portable instrument. And I've measured a number of them to see what the heck, how they charge the batteries. Because batteries, I never felt them really get really warm. I looked for that, and I said, let me see. You know, right away, that's an indication on the temperature of the battery, how fast it's being pushed. And I found that the good ones, the real good charges, in fact, I tried this experiment. I've used it on a number of my packs. I charge it at 10% of the rating. In other words, the 1,000 mils, I'll charge it at 100 mils. And never had a pack, you know, go bad prematurely. It seems like you hold it at about 10%. It seems like it's the right, reasonable way to charge any of the NiCad batteries or metal hydride, as far as I can see over.
In the old days, an awful lot of the nickel-cadmium batteries used that exact number. And so they told you the milliampere hours, and they told you to charge it at 0.1 C rate. C is capacity. So if it was a 1,200 milliampere hour battery, one-tenth of that would be 120 milliamps. So the recommendation would be to charge at 120 milliamps. Most NiCads in the old days, if you charge them at 10% of the milliampere hour rate in milliamperes, then you could do it quasi-continuously without creating damage. In other words, if 8 hours was the right number to bring it up to full charge, and you forgot about it for 16 hours, nothing really bad would happen. Forget about it for a week, and it's not good. It's starting to get into the point of damaging it, because all that extra current is just going into heat, and the extra heat is not doing good things inside. However, when it comes to these supercells you've got now, where the size of a battery used to be 1,200 milliampere hours, and now it's 2,700 milliampere hours, if you charge that at 1/10 C rate, 270 milliamps, I think that might be too much if you left it on continuously. So this 1/10 C rate with these super high capacity cells in the exact same size, I'm a little worried about whether or not that's still a safe number. I wonder if you've got an opinion on that one, Tom Bell. K2KEY, K2RIW in the tech net.
Yeah, I'll tell you. The ICOM charger that I have for the, you mentioned the 32, that thing is pushing a heck of a lot of current into those new batteries that are in there. They're getting warm. That pack is getting quite warm with that charger. That's why they tell you no more than a maximum of, I think, 15 hours or something from dead. But I'll tell you something. That is running too warm. I will not use it. And it is charging at more than 10%. I think I measured back the 1600 mil was charging at 210 or 220 mil rate, Dick. So they charge them very heavy now because people don't want to be, you know, inconvenienced. Just look at the cell phone even. They charge them, I see with my cell phone, I can take that battery almost from dead and get it fully charged with it if I, you know, watch it. A lot of people, of course, I'm sure, you know, don't pay much attention. But I see I got the battery fully charged right in 2 hours. And I don't know how much they're pushing that to, but can't get in there that easy. But on the ones of the handy talkies, I see all those charges are pushing them too high, Dick, over.
In the last couple of years, I've heard quite a few people complaining about the fact that their cell phone is no longer holding the charge correctly, and the battery may only be 6 months old, which is much too soon, as far as I'm concerned, for it to start giving them trouble. I'm convinced that many of the wall chargers supplied with cell phones are very dumb chargers, and unless the person reads the instruction manual very carefully, assuming the instruction manual was well written, and the person is willing to take the time to follow those instructions, which means try to estimate what percentage of time in hours you've used the cell phone, And if you're really smart, you know how many milliamps it draws in the standby mode, how many milliamps it typically draws when you're really making a phone call, and sort of like a diabetic calculation, you calculate how much carbohydrate you've consumed and therefore how much insulin you should inject. Well, it'd be nice to be able to calculate how much you've discharged the battery, or if the cell phone is really one with intelligent manufacturing, it's got a gas gauge on it where it keeps track of the state of charge of the battery by at least one of two different techniques, accumulating the number of milliamps of drain and measuring the voltage. There's usually a voltage versus state of charge curve for every real battery. So if the cell phone is smart enough, it's got a mode you can flip it into where it tells you the percentage of charge in the battery. Therefore, in theory, you know what length of time you should plug it into the wall charger and not drastically exceed that. Well, a lot of people say that, gee, I really want to make sure it's fully charged, but they just let it cook on the wall charger hour after hour, making sure that when they grab the phone and they go running out with it, they want it to be fully charged. Well, they may have left it for days on end on the darn charger, and they think that's good. It may not be good. So when in doubt, try to read the manual, try to check with people who know, and I, for one, if I was a big cell phone user, I would want to have a spare battery with some kind of a protection device on the contact. I'd like to be carrying a cell phone with a spare battery in my pocket with some kind of protection on its contact to make sure it doesn't come across my keys and make a short circuit in my pocket. You make a short circuit with a rechargeable battery in your pocket, guaranteed there's a high probability you're going to be awfully unhappy. Maybe with any further comments and all this, give me a call with us right now. K2RIW at the Tech Net.
OJO, Howard with a comment.
Okay, I heard Glenn and OJO in that order. Glenn, go right ahead.
Yeah, just two quick comments. One being that a lot of the new battery chargers that are coming out have toggle termination, meaning that they do have the temperature sensors inside the battery, and they will get warm. Most of the termination temperatures are usually between 48 and 55 degrees C. So you will feel it get warm, but as long as you see that the charging light goes out and the charge does terminate, just because the battery is getting warm doesn't necessarily mean that that you're really seeing any reduction in battery life in those particular chargers. Generally, you can tell those kinds of charges because you'll see the charging indicator light will be on during charging and then you'll see it go out. That's actually a very good and highly recommended mode of charging, especially for lithium ion. Not quite as critical for the nickel metal hydride. The other point that I was going to make is that on these new nickel metal hydride and lithium ion packs, both of them are wired in series to get higher voltages, you know, get 6, 12 volt, 18 volt packs. And the biggest damaging factor to these batteries are they don't have what they call a low voltage disconnect circuit, something that as the battery discharges down below the chemical voltage, in other words, if each cell is 1.2 volts, it might be able to discharge down to about 0.8. Now, the problem is if you completely discharge the pack, what's happening is one cell will start to deplete below 0.8 faster than another cell will in series. So what will eventually happen is one of the cells in series will wind up with a negative voltage across it during a deep discharge. That will definitely wipe out the pack. And just junk after that. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, in the case of nickel cadmium, any cell that is reverse charged starts growing whiskers that eventually become a short circuit between cathode and anode of that particular cell. So that's something you really got to worry about with your battery pack of nickel cadmium on your handy talkie. There are people who will recognize the fact that they got some kind of an alarm out of the handy talkie telling them the battery is near the bottom. And if life and limb is at risk, yeah, go ahead and keep using it. But if it's just convenient that you want to keep on talking beyond the point where your battery is where the handy talkie is recommending you go to charge, you're probably doing destruction when you go beyond that point. In the case of batteries that get hot with a smart charger, and a drop, you're walking a very narrow line there. If they've got a very good temperature sensing circuit, maybe 45 degrees centigrade is acceptable. Maybe. But there's a very narrow region beyond which you go to a little bit higher temperature, and that temperature sensor is not accurate, and you can be doing damage to the cells. A really smart charger, I think, does create a hell of a lot of heat on individual cells. That's an opinion. Mr. OJO, I didn't get your full call or your name. Please give us both and right ahead with your comment. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
KT2RIW.